Regardless of where you stand on the matter of data science sexiness, it's simply impossible to ignore the continuing importance of data, as well as our ability to analyze, organize, and contextualize them. Data are changing how our businesses and societies function. They are being used to solve a ton of interesting problems and shaping the questions we can ask of the world around us. Hi, I'm James Lee, and this is DataCast. Join me for raw conversations with practitioners from the worlds of AI, machine learning, statistics, and data science.
Listeners, this is DataCast. We have a long-form in-depth conversation with data practitioners to unpack the narrative journeys of their career. My guest today is Sam Abakuk, the CEO and co-founder of Ziblet, a full data stack observability platform. Before Ziblet, Samar was an executive director at one of the largest US investment banks in sales and trading in Asia, where she led key data and analytics initiatives. Samar holds an engineering degree from Ecole Centrale in Paris in applied mathematics, as well as a master's degree in statistics and data science. So Samar, with that introduction, it's my pleasure to welcome you on the show.
Thank you so much, James. Excited to be here.
So I want to start our conversation a little bit with your personal and educational background. According to my research, you were born in France, and then you later went to college at Ecole Centrale Paris to get an engineering degree in applied mathematics. Can you share briefly about your upbringing as well as your educational experience?
Sure, absolutely. So I was born in Morocco, actually. I'm originally from Morocco. I grew up in Paris. I went to Ecole Centrale Paris, as you mentioned. I have a degree in applied math statistics, and I have an engineering degree in applied maths. And yeah, growing up in Paris is extremely exciting. I don't know if you've been to Paris before, but it's a lovely city to grow up in. It's very rich. It's becoming more and more international, so that's great to see as well. And yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell me about, you know, some of your early interests in math? Like, what did you become?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So I was put on a math track when I was in high school because I was such a nerd and I was such a natural mathematician, and I had zero interest in literally like all the other subjects. So I kept on making excuses to my parents about how I didn't want to take any geography classes. I didn't want to learn about history, which in hindsight was a bit stupid. And if I'm the parent now, I wouldn't allow that. But they did. And so I was put on a very special math track, which led me to do the thing that we call in France, where you go and literally for 2 years, right after high school, all you do is study maths and physics. And like, you go really deep into that stuff. And then you sit through an exam where, depending on your national ranking, you get to enter one of the prestigious engineering schools that we have in Paris. So that's my journey. So I ended up going to Ecole Centrale Paris and obviously continued on studying math, and I ended up getting a degree in applied math.
I see. So you already cultivated that love for math like early on in your teenage year, and you kind of continued the interest throughout later on.
Yeah, I've always had a passion for the topic, and I guess as the, you know, earlier, I was also good at it in high school and even before that. And being able to only study math and go deeper into the different topics was really a blessing. And I think being in Paris, that was something that was actually available to me. So that's good.
Yeah. And in fact, I believe you also actually got a master's degree in statistics and data science from University of Paris in Dauphine, VSL. And so it sounds like you start specializing in a specific branch of math at this point, right?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can tell
actually,
more about...
it was in conjunction. Yeah, sorry. It was in conjunction with my degree at Ecole Centrale Paris. So Ecole Centrale Paris is an engineering school, and my major was applied mathematics. My minor was actually contemporary art. So it's a temporary art, contemporary art. So completely random. And in the final year, you get to choose to specialize in one area. So I chose statistics, and I did like a double degree with the University of Paris Dauphine. And that's where I got a second master's degree in statistics. It was pretty intense because I was doing both courses at the same time. But I really enjoyed it, and it really built a good foundation for me for building resilience for later on in my career, because it was really intense.
Mm. Yeah, do you recall any favorite classes for that degree?
Yeah. Oh my God. College was 10 years ago or more than that. So I'll try to remember something. Obviously, I was very passionate about statistics and data science was just becoming a thing at the time. And I wanted to take courses in that space. Specifically, the thing that I enjoyed the most, obviously math, it can get pretty theoretical and it can get very abstract very quickly just by the nature of what it is. But towards the end, I really enjoyed, or I became more inclined towards finding real life application for the theory that I was learning in math. So to give you an example of something that I really enjoyed, I do remember we worked on a project where as part of the statistics course, we were supposed to find a real life story application for a course that we were taking. And I got the opportunity to work with a pretty large gaming company. And the idea was to help them build a predictive model to get better at how they look at the behaviors of the players and create all the challenges and how the game plays based on that, which was great. But what I really enjoyed about that and the reason why it stuck with me all over these years is that not only was it based on advanced statistic principles and hardcore mathematics, but they were also working with a group of psychologists that were giving input based on human behavior and human psychology. And the idea was to work with them and try to translate that into something that could be consumed by a predictive model. So it was pretty interesting. Actually, in another life, I was a psychologist, so I studied psychology for sure. If I were to do it again, I would study psychology. It's definitely a topic that I'm extremely passionate about. So that's why this experience stuck with me.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that context. It sounds like you enjoyed pursuing classes where there's a combination of both the technical aspect of mathematics, but also some of the real world application in this case, like collaboration with other disciplines as well. So it's really not just about the academic side, but also where it applies to other things.
For sure. And actually, it's interesting that I ended up in data because that's a discipline that echoes just what you said. It has a solid technical foundation. And at the same time, it leverages a lot of business principles and data is supposed to drive something within the business. So it has that aspect of human interaction and business sense in general as well. So that's, I guess, what I enjoy the most.
For sure. After finishing your education in France, you spent more than 5 years at the Hong Kong office of one of the largest US investment banks, where you led key data and analytics initiatives as the executive director of the sales and trading function. How would you describe your overall career there?
It was intense and it was great and I learned a ton. So right after I graduated from college in France, I got offered a job in Hong Kong. Up until then, I had never been to Hong Kong. So it was a complete adventure and it was a big adventure. Ended up moving to Hong Kong in 2015, joined one of the largest US banks as an analyst in the equity sales and trading division. And I really was very quickly thrown into an environment where data is used in real time to make big decisions, an environment where in general, there's a lot of intensity and there's a lot of high stress and high impact of the work you do in a way, because you are managing large sums of money all day, every day. And I really thrived in that environment and it pushed boundaries in my personality that I didn't even know existed. So it was definitely a fantastic learning experience. I worked with some of the smartest people that I know. Now, overall, and back to the data initiatives and everything, how that played out specifically. So I was in equity sales and trading. We used data in real time to make decisions and to make recommendations to clients and to the bank in terms of trade ideas. So obviously when there's a delay in the data that we're receiving, if there was a what we call a freshness problem, if a dashboard was breaking or something like that, it was a big problem. And being in that position where there's high expectations from the business, from stakeholders internally and externally about what the data delivers, I had a first row seat to literally everything and anything that can go wrong as far as data quality or lack thereof goes. And it's not to the fault of the bank that I used to work for or the infrastructure that we had, because we had a pretty modern infrastructure and we had the extremely smart people who were taking care of it. But the access to data was reserved to a group of very technical people. There was no data democratization, as we call it these days. And so as people who sit on the business and who are responsible for revenue and for growing the business operations, it was a struggle for us to become data-driven. I went and I led a couple initiatives that were aimed at democratizing data, creating or improving the access to data by both business stakeholders and overall broadly speaking data consumers. And we invested a lot of time and resources in making that happen and creating that intelligence layer. But even with a very modern data stack, we couldn't get around data quality issues, and it was still a big pain, and it was actually halting the adoption of what we're hoping was the foundation of a data-driven culture. So that's what motivated me personally, and that's what led to the creation of Stick.
Yeah, thanks for providing that high-level summary. Maybe just follow up on those points. First of all, like you mentioned, the earlier part of your answer is like that job is really high stress, high intensity environment, and that pushed the boundaries of your personality, you said, right?
Yes.
I'm curious, can you talk more about that? How did, because these say you become a founder, right? How did, you know, that experience working there make you more driven in general in order to like, you know, these days start a company?
Yeah. That's a really good question. The bank that I worked for is pretty known for its strong culture. And that is one of the best things about working in a company. That's because they early on, and then especially in my case, when you start your career at a place like that, very early on, some very strong values get instilled in you and end up shaping the way you see the world and the way you think about goals and achievements and ambition in general. They end up shaping that. And so we had a very big culture that was built around winning, excellence, ambition, being the best. And so I've always been like that, but working there helped me really see the potential of where together as a team we could go and how I could push myself to get better every day. I was constantly challenged because I was constantly surrounded by people who were way smarter than me. And for me, that was the best takeaway from that experience, because I was constantly pushing the boundaries and seeing where my brain could go and where my habits and skills could go. Now, back to how it helps me today, or how that experience has helped me or is helping me today as a founder. When you're in that kind of environment, especially the trading floor is a very special kind of environment, you end up building resilience very quickly. And resilience is a muscle, right? And so the more you are exposed to situations where, you know, there is high expectation, there is a lot of things that can go wrong, there's a lot of conflict, there's a lot of high tension type of encounters, that builds your resilience and it makes that muscle stronger and stronger. And I think now that definitely taught me some things that I am using in my career as an entrepreneur now, and that I will definitely carry with me for the rest of my life. And I think that the environment that I worked for is a lot to thank for that. I don't think if I had started my career somewhere else, I would have been the person that I am today. Let's just put it this way.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I agree. I really like your framing of how you can cultivate resilience early on in your career, because entrepreneurship is always about dealing with rejection and feeling being resilient.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You build resilience and you build grit.
Yeah.
And so you end up having like almost a playbook about how to deal with things and how to deal with them quickly and how to learn from the experiences that life throws at you, the good and the bad.
Yeah. So circling back into data and analytics, and you talk about that answer in your previous answer, you have that first eye view understanding, even in the large environment that the bank you work for, data quality is still an issue. And even with adoption and tooling and the infrastructure that they have, that's one of the core motivation for you to spark on your own journey. Since January of 2021, you have been the co-founder and CEO of Ziplet, whose mission is to reduce data entropy by way of a full data stack observability platform. And I believe you co-founded the company with Wachi Fatala and Wissam Fatala. Can you share the story behind the founding of the company?
Yeah, absolutely. So I met Wissam in engineering school 10 years ago, and we've been best friends since then. We initially bonded over in models and we ended up being friends over the years, and we kept in touch while he was having his career at Uber, at Amazon and at Uber. And then Wesley, as you can gather, shares the same last name as Wissam, and he's his older brother. So that's how we, the three of us, know each other. And when I was at working in investment banking, and as we were experimenting with our data and analytics initiatives, I turned to both of them to ask for advice and see if I could learn some of the best practices that they were implementing as data practitioners for some very tech-savvy companies and see what I could take away from that and apply it at my job. So that's how the conversation started in, say, 2017, 2018. Now, when we started at the company having data quality issues and I started to see the impact that it had on slowing the adoption of data-driven decision-making, I turned to both of them and I was like, hey, do you have any ideas on how we can fix this at my company? Turns out that they were experiencing similar issues at their respective companies. And we looked at the problem and we said, they seem to be causing a lot of problems for a lot of companies of different scans and different type of businesses. And we did a ton of research and we ended up, the three of us, leaving our jobs and starting the company in January 2021. That's the story.
Yeah. What about them that make you believe that they can be good co-founders?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. Because we've known each other for such a long time and we've been such close friends for a while, I know that we share the same values. And I know that we have similar views on how the world works and how we see the world work. And I think that's extremely important in a co-founder because you want, obviously, when you go and start a company, like as an entrepreneur, per default, we need to be extremely ambitious, right? And when you start the company with somebody else, it is very important that you are on the same level of ambition, that you have the same type of like hunger and the same type of excitement about building things and creating things. That's one. The second part is more about what I said earlier, resilience and grit. So I know them on a personal level and I know the type of experiences that they went through in the past and I know what they had to overcome in the past. So I know that they are very resilient people. And to me, that was extremely important because when you start a company with someone or two co-founders, which is my case, what ends up happening is that ideally, if you're lucky, your down moments are coincide with moments where they have more optimism than you. And so they can balance that out. I could have never been a solo founder. I have extreme high level of respect for solo founders. I think they're superhuman. But in my case, because I had that personal relationship with them, I can just go and vent and say, hey, I'm exhausted. Hey, I don't know if this is going to work. And because we're friends, we're able to have those conversations and not have them or me question their commitment towards what we're building together. And I think that was another point that's extremely important is that because we know each other and we trust each other, it actually ended up being a superpower for the company as far as execution goes. Because the Wesley is the CTO, Wissam is the CPO, I'm the CEO. We have pretty distinct roles and we have actually pretty complementary personality for that matter. And so when Wesley makes a decision about technology, I don't have to go and check, even though I have the background that I can understand what he's doing, I don't have to go and check and ask him to explain to me why he made such and such a choice. And the same goes for Wissam and the same goes for them with me. And I think that's extremely helpful in a co-founder relationship if you want to be efficient and be quick about how you make decisions.
So yeah, it sounds like it's a combination of the long-term personal relationship that you have with them, the resilience that they also have from their past background, as well as the domain expertise that align with the relevant roles or responsibility that you can ensure full trust among the founders.
Absolutely.
Let's go deeper and talking more about the product itself and dissecting the key capabilities back into the CPLAT platform. Would you mind explaining the concept of full data stack observability to the uninitiated?
Sure. So let's start with observability. So observability is a concept that comes from software engineering. And before that comes from, and software observability in software engineering is a concept that relies on three main pillars, which are metrics, traces, and logs. And essentially, companies like Datadog, New Relic, and Splunk, et cetera, have emerged over the past decade or so to solve the problem of lack of visibility and to achieve observability for modern organizations by giving them a bird's eye view into what's happening inside the infrastructure and application. So the idea behind software observability is to equip software engineers with all sorts of information, detailed information that they need to know about the functioning of their applications and what's running on the infrastructure to make sure that they keep an eye on the health status of the infrastructure and of the applications and ensure sustainable functioning of it. take something very simple as at the end of your day, you tune into Netflix and you watch something, you watch one of the series that you like. That wouldn't be possible without a software observability, because that ensures the continuity of the service of Netflix. So that's an example. Now, data observability is a relatively new category. And the idea behind it is fairly similar to software in the sense that we want to provide a bird's eye view and full visibility and help companies achieve trust and reliability of their data assets by connecting a collection of signals across the whole data and the metadata and infrastructure, and making sure that both data producers and data consumers are aware of what's going on inside their data and data infrastructure. Practically speaking, at CPI, our framework is based on three main pillars: metrics, metadata, and lineage. In metrics, we look at a set of data quality rules or data quality control that we think should define the basis of an anomaly detection. So you want to look at those metrics to define the health status of your data assets. So we look at things that, you know, at the metadata level: freshness, completeness, distribution, volume, schema changes, etc. We look at things at the data level. Am I supposed to receive an email address? I'm getting a zip code. Is it a zip code in Paris? Then you should start with 75, etc. Things like this. And finally, you also need to ensure that the infrastructure supporting the data product is working properly. And infrastructure in data goes by a lot of aspects. But more importantly, the pipelines that are holding the data together and holding the data application together. And so we also want to make sure that the pipelines are functioning properly, the orchestration layer is working properly, the modeling layer is working properly, to give data practitioners a holistic view over what's going on inside their data platform and get ahead of any anomalies that could lead to business catastrophe. That's the approach.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for giving a bird's eye view on this concept. And we'll talk about some of the specific component in a bit. I'm just curious, did you and your team come up with this concept from the get-go when starting Simlab, or how did you position the company with this terminology?
Yeah, that's a great question. So data quality issues, broadly speaking, have existed for as long as businesses started using data to leverage business, right? Nobody's reinventing the wheel. What happened, though, is that over the past few years, there has been a huge revolution that took place in the data engineering and data infrastructure and tooling space, more broadly speaking, that made a lot of the processes around data integration, data modeling, made them easier and automated and freed up a lot of bandwidth for data engineers, made a lot of use cases actually possible. Fast forward to today, where companies are embracing the complexity, are relying on a lot of external data sources, and want to make sure that the spending that they make on their data infrastructure has a good return on investment, that everything is functioning properly, that business users have access to data, reliable data, et cetera, actually puts data quality monitoring or data quality management, broadly speaking, back under the spotlight. Now, as I said, observability is a concept that comes from other industries, right? But in the concept or in the context of where we are today and the whole movement around the modern data stack, a lot of solutions are emerging under this new framework that is data observability and trying to solve that problem. CPI's approach is full stack. So we are a top of stack layer. We sit on top of an existing data stack. We do anomaly detection, root cause analysis, and incident management reporting. And we provide monitoring and observability for the data assets, regardless of where they sit within the value chain.
Yeah. So you're already thinking about that movement that put the data quality monitoring back to the game and then providing solution for the full data stack, right? Not just any single.
Right. It's also, in a way, what's going to shape the future for data observability as a category, right? Like, you want to also look at some more complex infrastructures. A lot of companies are still between legacy and modern type of infrastructures. And lineage is becoming increasingly important in cloud migrations and migration projects in general. And so it'll be interesting to see how that shapes the future of data observability as a category.
Yeah, for sure. So let's zoom in on those three pillars that you talked about for data backend, the platform tackles data quality problems with automated monitoring coverage and over 50 data templates, I believe. Can you share some of the relevant metrics as well as a few best practices to deal with data quality?
Yeah, absolutely. So our approach to CIFLE when it comes to data quality monitoring or anomaly detection is based on two approaches. So we have a purely machine learning based approach, and I will explain that in a bit because I get extremely passionate about the topic when we're speaking about ML-based anomaly detection, because I think that it's either done right or it's done horribly wrong. And the other way we do data quality monitoring or anomaly detection at CIFLE is rule-based to allow to cover more niche use cases and give freedom to the user to define their own use case, because ultimately we come up with what we think makes sense and what we think based on our experiences makes sense as far as quality metrics. But ultimately, it's the user that knows best their use case and what fits in, what they want to monitor. Now, if I want to go back on the metric, so as I said, we look at data anomaly detections from three angles. So we look at data anomalies at the data level. So we go and look at drift within the data. We look at format validation, field profiling. Some of the examples I mentioned earlier, are you supposed to have a zip code in Paris, in which case it should have? We look at anomalies. And so here we look at things like freshness. Is the data up to date? Volume, am I receiving or ingesting the right number of rows or the data in the right volume that I'm expecting to ingest? We look at things like changes in schema, because that can be a big thing. And then finally, and this is also one of the key differentiators for CIFLE, because we not only look at data and metadata anomalies, we also look at anomalies at the infrastructure layer so that we can become even more proactive about data quality issues. Often a broken pipeline is not only consuming a lot of resources because it's anomalous and it's running and it's consuming compute, but it's likely to propagate and cause a lot of data issues downstream. Do you want to detect the anomalies when it's in the anomaly when it's on a BI dashboard? No, you want to detect it when the pipeline is running and you can still stop it and do proper troubleshooting. So we look at that infrastructure, that pipeline layer as well. And we have connectors that go deep into the orchestration, the modeling layer, the connectivity, Airflow, and Fivetran and tools like that to make sure that everything is functioning properly at the pipeline level before things propagate and become data anomalies. So that's the other element that we bring into the table.
Yeah, thanks for highlighting some of the key metric as well as the approach that Diplett has been tackled to deal with data quality. Now, the second pillar that you talk about is data lineage. And I believe that this data lineage solution with field level lineage, root cause analysis, and incident management business impact assessment.
Yep.
So my question is twofold. First, can you explain why is data lineage important? And second, how is Diplett approach building a data lineage tool to help your customers?
Yeah. So first of all, lineage is a concept that still fairly misunderstood, in my opinion, and there's still a lot of confusion around it. We, from the get-go, when we sat down, me and my co-founders, and we started thinking about what we wanted the tool to achieve. Obviously, I come from like a data consumer business leader type of background, whereas my co-founders come from like a pure analytic and data engineering background. And so when we sat down, it was almost as if we were a data team and each one of us was vouching for a different persona, if that makes sense. And ultimately, that actually emulates a lot what happens in real life with our customers and with our prospective customers. People are still unsure about ownership when it comes to data quality, which ultimately ends up being the ownership of nobody. And then until somebody from the C-level starts screaming because they are so fed up with receiving the wrong numbers, and then all of a sudden, people are starting to think, see what they can do about data quality. So this is the problem we want to solve with CIFLE. This is, in a way, what we call data entropy. And that's where the full data stack approach comes from and comes into the picture. Because we wanted a tool that can speak to both data engineers and data consumers and help both data engineers and data consumers become better and more proactive about data quality management. Now, granted, these two personas are very different. They don't speak the same language. They can barely speak to one another. And so the challenge for us was to create the glue between the two. And that glue is the lineage. Anecdotally, the very first lines of code we wrote at CIFLE were to build a lineage solution. Because we wanted, as I said, like to create that glue between the two, but more importantly, to give context to the anomalies that the tool would. So practically speaking, when you receive an alert from CIFLE that tells you, hey, something is breaking or there is a rule that failed or something like that, what do you do with the alert? And this is where a lot of data quality initiatives fail. And this is where a lot of things I've seen in the past fail. Because in a modern, complex infrastructure and environment, it's impossible to keep track of how the data assets are related. It's just impossible to go and do troubleshooting manually. And so because we're able to leverage the lineage, which I think, which is one of the pillars actually of our product today, we're able to, as a data engineer, tell you or give you the upstream context to the root cause analysis. And at the same time, to data consumers, we give the downstream impact. So what you mentioned, we call the incident management and business impact assessment. So that each one of the two personas can receive actionable information from Tiffany and actionable insight to get better and get proactive about managing data catastrophes. So that's how we're leveraging Lineage. And I guess that also answers the second part of your question of how Tiffany's approach has been helping customers by leveraging Lineage, because, and there's been a lot of research on the topic, troubleshooting data incidents is the hardest part. Roughly 50% of data engineer time. So when you have an end-to-end lineage like we do, you can optimize your data resources greatly by having something that automatically computes the lineage, directly points to the root cause, and while at the same time informing the consumers of how they might be impacted. That's why lineage is extremely powerful and is one of the key pillars in our product.
Yeah, thanks for sharing the importance of lineage, and I really like your framing of how it become the glue between data producer and data consumer and serve as like the almost the communication layer that allows these two different personas to collaborate and have full ownership what they need to do. Because we currently also in a topic of collaboration and allow teams to work with data better. The last pillars of the separate platform is a data catalog with a powerful data search engine and centralized documentation for all data assets. Can you highlight the power of this feature?
Yeah. We published a blog post recently that is called Data Observability and Data Discovery Belong Together or Better Together, something like that, that I'll share with you at the end of the episode, which highlights really our philosophy behind having a catalog in the product. Data teams or business teams use data catalogs as an entry point to discover and find assets that they need to use, right? But if you can't trust the data that you find in your data catalog, then there's no point in having a data catalog because you're just going to be looking for rubbish data assets. And so because of Tiffany, we're able to push that data quality and hence data information, the only way to, I guess, serve it to the user in a consumable way is to have a catalog. So think of the catalog as like the entry point to Tiffany. You come in, you search your data assets in the catalog, and more importantly, you can see the health status of the data assets that you look for, and you can see their lineage, and you can see which team is using them. We have this thing that we call a temperature, so it sends you the most queried assets and stuff like that, so you can get closer to this utopic concept that is the single source of truth. So having data catalog and data observability under the same tool or within the same platform makes a lot of sense in getting closer to what everybody calls their single source of truth.
I see, yeah. That's a pretty interesting framing. So that like catalog and observability go in the same umbrella. Yeah, I'm excited to see some of the more thought that you come from your team related to this topic of discovery and catalog very soon.
Yeah.
And another thing that you also briefly discussed this in one of your previous answer on the quality question, but my understanding is CPET can seamlessly integrate with different data sources and different data tools in the stack, ranging from dbt to Airflow to Fibo, just to name a few examples. How do you see the role of the CPET platform, or even broader in context, the full data stack observability tools fit into the quickly evolving modern data stack?
So our approach with Tiffany and in pioneering this, what we call the full data stack observability platform, is to really sit on top of an existing data stack. Whether your data stack is highly fragmented, decentralized, whether it relies on a variety of different data sources, or wherever that might be, full data stack observability allows you to actually navigate through the mess, make sense of the mess, and embrace the complexity, and reduce what we call data entropy, right? Because companies are realizing that complexity is inevitable. And data entropy, as we call it, is inevitable if you're growing and if you're scaling to a certain degree. So our approach with Sydney is to enable companies to still take the most of their data assets, still be able to embrace the flexibility that comes with having multiple tools and multiple data sources, and really utilize data to its full potential. And the only way you can do that is by making sure that the output of the data platform are reliable and trustworthy. And that's where data observability is very important. Now, the modern data stack is an ecosystem that is evolving quite a lot. And it's actually one of the reasons why I feel extremely lucky to be building a company in this space. It almost reminds me of my days at Goldman. There's always something new popping and happening and you need to adapt to it. So it's pretty refreshing. Now, data observability, and specifically speaking, the approach of Sydney of being full stack, in a way, we don't really care about how complex the data set gets or how fragmented it gets, because we are the glue that's going to make sure that everything is working properly, everything is reliable, and everything is visible. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah. No, no matter what the complexity is, I think you still be able to serve as the glue and sit on top of it. So it's really agnostic.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I think, or that's why we're big believers of this full stack approach, because monitoring and observability, if you only watch one area or only focus on one part of the data stack, you might do it really well, right? Like you might be the super powerful anomaly detection model that only sits on top of the warehouse. But then what happens when the data leaves the warehouse? What happens before the data even lands in the warehouse? How can you ensure that there is nothing that can go wrong there? Because there is a ton of things that can go wrong still in other areas. So the full stack approach is really, in our opinion, the only way that you can just embrace the complexity in your modern infrastructure and make sure that the return on investment of everything that you put into your data infrastructure, whether that's tooling, people, technology, is actually optimized.
Yeah, for sure. I guess another follow-up question to that point about that approach is, I assume, want to integrate with a majority of these tools in different part of the stack, right? Like ranging from ETL to warehouse to analytics orchestration. How do you and your team thinking about prioritizing this integration? Because I assume it takes some work, right, to like actually do technical partnership.
Yeah.
How do you think about choosing the right partner to integrate?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So for that, it's been relatively simple for us. So we built a very strong, and this is my CTO, my co-founder and CTO is a lot to thank for that. And he's a true visionary and a great software engineer. We know from the beginning that we were going to be full stack. We built a very lean microservice infrastructure that allows us to be extremely agile when it comes to not only creating integrations, but shipping new features in general. And because we know from the beginning that we were going to be very integration heavy and that we were going to, that our approach, we were going to integrate with as many tools as possible within the modern data stack, we knew that was going to be a big focus for us. And so we have a team that only looks at integration. Now, how do we prioritize integrations? That becomes more of like a go-to-market and making sure that our current customers are happy, prospective customers are happy, and where we see the trends go in the space in general. So it's a matter of figuring out what makes sense for us, but at the same time, what makes sense for our customers.
I see, yeah. So combination of the design of the product to make it easy to integrate.
Yeah.
As well as go-to-market motion to see the trends of the market as well as customer requests, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I saw recently that Zipbit has been released a couple of the new product features. One is called Flow Stopper to stop vulnerable pipelines from running the orchestration layer. And the other one is called Matrix Observability to extend the observability framework to the semantic layer. Would you mind touching on these new capabilities?
Yeah. What do you think of the name Flow Stopper, by the way? We had quite a debate about this name.
I guess it's, I don't know. Yeah, I guess I need to.
Is it self-explanatory? Does it give you an idea of what it does? Or we completely missed it on this one?
I did read the blog release and you explained it like it stop broken pipeline from damaging bad data. So
yeah.
Flow Stopper, it can be, makes sense. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, so Flow Stopper, this is back to what I said earlier about being able to detect data quality issues. at the pipeline level before it becomes a problem for data in production. And so the natural progression for us there was to connect to the orchestration layer. And so we started with a native connector to Airflow. That wasn't enough. And so that's where the Flowstopper feature came into the picture. Concretely speaking, the way Flowstopper works is that simply we connect to your orchestrator of choice, whether that's Airflow, Dexter, or anything else. We do that either by using a native integration like we have with Airflow or Dexter or via CLI. And the data quality rule or the quality control will be inserted at the pipeline level to make sure that anomalies can be detected at the orchestration layer. In other words, if CIFLE detects an anomaly, the data engineers will get a chance with Flowstopper to know that the pipeline is breaking or is likely to break and stop it before, to troubleshoot it before it further propagates and becomes a business problem. So essentially, it's a way for data engineers to integrate testing into their pipelines at the orchestration layer to ensure that there's like a continuity, the monitoring and avoid a broken pipeline from propagating and consuming computes and whatnot.
Yeah, for sure. And that's the Flowstopper feature, right? Can you talk more about?
Yes, you asked about metrics.
Yeah.
Yeah. So metrics is a relatively new feature. We literally came out with it last week, which was actually pretty funny because it was almost like at the same time as DBT announcing their semantic layer. So it was interesting to see that. And I feel like in general, the semantic layer is a hot topic right now. And there's a lot of new development happening in space. So the metrics layer we see obviously as a translator between data in the warehouse and the business, which in theory is an excellent step towards data democratization. However, the least technical the users are, and in this case, the business users, the less comfortable they get about using data assets without knowing where they're coming from and how they're computed and without having an idea about their reliability. And so as part of our full data stack observability framework, and again, because we are able to compute that lineage end-to-end from injection all the way to consumption, we're able to push the lineage to the semantic layer so a user can go and see either create a metric on CIFLE or import existing metrics from either a metric store or a BI tool or directly from DBT. So you can discover your metric catalog. So that's again where pretty good use case for the catalog. So you find the metric and then you can click on it and you find all the data quality rules that are watching that metric. What's the health status of the metric? Is it reliable? Can you use it? What's its lineage? Where it's coming from? How it's computed? Who's using it? Etc. So it really gives, by again, pushing the boundaries of the lineage, it gives more power to business users to have a better level of confidence in the data assets that they use. So that's really the idea behind this feature. And I think in general, we're moving to a world where self-serve analytics is actually finally happening. It's not just a buzzword. And so we're seeing more and more focus about the semantic layer in general. And I think observability and reliability are going to be big topics there as well, because you can't give data to the consumers if you can't give them at least a certain level of confidence of how reliable it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for touching on kind of the context and the development has benefited both of these features. I'm excited to see the sort of adoption of these features for CIFLE as adapt to some of the new trends and requests from data practitioners. And we touched on some of the high-level thought leadership aspect later on in your conversation. But I just want to take a quick sidewalk from talking about specific product features and talk about the general concept of data culture, given that you have experience in the past, right? Leading data teams in your previous job, right? So while doing the research for this conversation, I came across this very in-depth guide that you wrote on the CIFLE blog on how to build modern data teams. And blog post aims to give partners on what to focus on, how to prioritize, and some other consideration that could benefit modern leaders of organization taking the first step towards data maturity. Can you unpack some of the key takeaways from that article?
Yeah. First of all, I love how deep you went in your research. So the article really is aimed at, as you said, like speaking to people who are either just getting started about building a data practice or people who come from different backgrounds and are taking on projects that involve data and involve different stakeholders internally from engineering, from business, etc. And that's exactly the position that I was in the past. So I was a business leader. And then because of my job and my responsibility, me and my team had to become data-driven. And the only way to do that was to go and take on the initiative of making the team data-driven because I was their leader and they were expecting me to do something about it. And when I started looking into it, and this is, even though in theory, I have an engineering background, I know how to code to a certain degree. Obviously, I would not go and add anything to it. I think our software engineers would take offense in that. But I am a relatively technical person. That said, when I was assigned this intelligence layer, I had no idea where to start. And I felt really intimidated by everything that was going on in technology space. I felt really surpassed by all the developments that were happening. I was almost like ashamed to call my friends who were in the data space and be like, hey, what is DBT? Or what is, or what do I do? Or how can data from point A to point B? We have a database. How can I create a dashboard? Questions like about technicalities of the job like this. But I also had a lot of other questions like, who do I hire? How should the data platform look like? What type of skills should I go and look for when hiring people for the data team? And I spent a lot of time and I did a lot of research about the topic and I leaned on people around me to learn and I made a lot of mistakes along the way. And the aim of that blog is to really reflect on my experience and share some pointers with people who might be going through something similar in giving like a playbook. This is, if you're lost, this is where you should start. That's really how I see that blog. And so in the blog, we go from basic things like org structure, where should the data team sit, what are the use cases, how do you want to get started, etc. to, okay, are you thinking about something centralized? Are you thinking about taking a data mesh approach? What kind of tools should you be looking for? All the way to the hiring aspect, like your first hire in the data team, should they be full stack and speak SQL fluently, or should they have some software engineering skills? And I try to dissect that, and I try to give examples based on the level of maturity of the business, because again, like a company that's just getting started doesn't have the same expectations about data and the data team the same way an established company may have different expectations. So that's really the thinking behind that blog. And that was why we published it.
Yeah, for sure. I'll be sure to include the link to the show notes as well.
Thank you.
Business had a chance to go over very detailed and it touched everything from like to your point, organizational structure to choosing the right technologies that are stuck in a platform as well as the hiring plan. And as we in the topic of hiring, let's take off your product hat and put on your CEO hat. Hiring is a critical responsibility of any early stage. But of what valuable lesson have you learned to attract the right people who are excited about the mission of Zipit?
Oh, I love this question. So obviously I did a lot of hiring in the past when I was in sales. But at the time, attracting candidates was actually relatively easy. I just go and say, hey, I'm hiring for the largest bank in the world. Do you want to come join us? So the brand was helpful. When we started hiring with Snake, when especially in the very early days when it was just me and my co-founders and we were looking for literally the first person to hire, we didn't have that brand. We could barely articulate the product's vision. So we really had nothing to say. And so what we did is we went and looked within our network. Who are the people that we know? Because after the first hire, when you bring somebody along, when you're just co-founders of the company, almost the founder as well, because not only are they going to be an extension of the founding team and one of the founders, but in the eyes of future hires, that person is going to be considered almost as a founder. And so you have to be extremely careful about who you hire first. And we got extremely lucky there because we hired somebody that we've known for a decade. We want to engineer and work together. So we knew what to expect in terms of personality fit. And again, back to what I said earlier, like the overall values, the resilience, the grit, the ambition. So everything ticked our boxes. It was a matter of, and this was the easiest part, of whether they have the technical abilities to do the job. And they did. that was our first hire. And then from then, we went and continued to leverage our network. So when we brought him on, his name is Vassal. Vassal brought along somebody from his present team. And then my co-founder hired some people from his previous team. So until we were 10 employees, we were literally, we all knew each other and we all kind of worked together in the past. Now the challenge becomes how you go from that almost a comfort zone of knowing everybody and having worked with them in the past to extending and expanding on that and bringing new people along and selling the company as a brand to new hires. And that's a lot of, it, obviously it's a lot of trial and error, but more importantly, hopefully by that time, you would have gotten better at selling the company, selling the vision. You would have some proof points like early customers, investors, and stuff like that, that you can show to future hires to show them, to really sell them the opportunity and show them and get them excited about it. Now, and I learned this the hard way in my previous experience. When you hire extremely smart people, you need to give them space and you need to give them opportunity and space to grow. You can't hire somebody who's extremely smart and tell them what to do. And when you're a founder of a company, it's a very fine line to be like, hey, I think we should do this, go do that. Or, hey, you're smart. You're smarter than me in something, in a lot of things. That's why I hired you. And so what should we be doing? What do you think about this? And we started having actually a process now where when we interview people, we ask them or we give them a demo of the product and say, tell us one or two things we're doing wrong. Where are we terribly? What is one thing about the product that is terribly badly done? What would you change if you joined us tomorrow? And I think that not only gives the people confidence to explore their full potential and eventually bring value to you as a company, but it also gives them comfort in thinking, okay, I'm not just coming to this clique type of environment where they're all friends and they all known each other for 10 years and I'm just going to come in and be completely on the outside. So that's, knock on wood, that's been working for us pretty well. And obviously, as the team grows, we try to build a certain sense of culture, a sense of belonging. We communicate on everything. We are a hybrid company. So we have an office, but a lot of people are remote. So we try to meet up regularly. We talk a lot. We have the thing that we do every Monday, which I think has been extremely helpful to us. And I recommend a lot of early stage companies to do the same. We have a Monday meeting every day at 2 p.m. where we talk about everything and anything. No topic is off limits except work. We don't talk about work. So literally people come in and they tell us about how they've been sleeping well or not, who's getting married, who's getting a dog, who went on a hike, who's sick, who's burnt out. We literally, nothing is off limits. And that helped us create a sense of community and a sense of belonging. And it helped us get to know each other on a different level. And actually, it also helps with the company culture because you start to get to know people on a personal level. And you also start to understand how they react or give a, yeah, just start understanding how they react to certain work situations. And that's been a blessing. And I feel extremely fortunate to be working with some amazing people that we have on the team. And we're hiring and we're growing super fast. So if anybody's interested, contact me.
Yeah, for sure. And just to recap your answer, at the beginning, relying on personal network, right? Like previous connection, previous job, friends of friends. And then to bootstrap outside the co-founders. And then after that, to expand outside of that comfort zone, you ask the prospect guy to for the feedback for their own product so that they can feel the ownership if they join the company and so then feel like they'd be micromanaged. And then,
yeah. And also branding yeah. is extremely important. And even at the very early stages, you need to be mindful about how you are perceived on the outside. It's important for customers and gaining overall visibility, but it's extremely important for hiring because like today, for example, I tweeted about this the other day. Somebody read one of our blog articles and applied. And he said to the guy who interviewed him, I read the blog. I think you're building a great product. So I applied. And I think that there's some small things that you can do here and there that can improve overall branding of the company and as a potential place to work.
So actually on the topic of branding, I'm curious, what is the meaning behind the name Ziplett?
I keep asking our marketing team that we need to have a frequently asked question page on our website that explains what Sifflet is. Sifflet means whistle in French. So that's for the alerting part in the product.
Okay. Got it. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
And then one last point about company culture. And you talked about in the previous answer from holding meetings where not talking about work to understand people at the personal level. Now, as Sifflet continue to grow and hire more employees, how have you and the broader leadership team thinking about defining values, cultural values, and and like even writing handbooks for communication, that kind of thing? And I'm sure that's like a challenging part when all the other tasks that I have to do.
Yeah, I love this question a lot. So initially, when we knew we were going to start hiring people and everything, we sat down with my co-founders and we tried to write down our company values and what we think should constitute the foundation of the company culture. And we didn't really communicate about it. We didn't say that to anybody. We kept it between us. And then we were like a year from now, let's reopen this. We sent it in an email. Let's reopen this email and see if those values still apply today. And I literally, a year later, went on the company Slack and I shared the list of those values and I asked everybody to vote on what they think constitute the values of Sifflet. And we came up with a pretty interesting set of values, which I think make more sense as we grow as a team, because you can't just expect to define, like, for default, a value is something that is almost inherent, or you don't have to think about it or instill it in somebody. It comes almost naturally, right? And so instead of going and being like, hello team, these are our values, please respect them and please communicate them. And yeah, like this is us. We thought it was better to create the definition or the set of values and define them together as a team as we grow. And we will do the same exercise a year from now when we're going to be 45 or 50 people. And I'm going to go around and ask them to vote about what they think are the values of the company. So I think it's an ever-evolving exercise. And I don't think you should think of it as something that the founders have to decide what it is or the leadership has to decide what it is. No, it's the building block of the company culture and how people interact with each other. So it should come from everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that insight. Now, another group that obviously is very important for the company success is your customers, right? Finding early adopters is very challenging for any early stage entrepreneur. What are some of the challenges that your team have to overcome to find some of the early design partners?
Yeah. So in the early days, and obviously like even on our stage, like our customers are early adopters because the company is still relatively young. But in the very early days, we, again, relied on our network and the network of our investors and advisors to find companies that first had the type of challenges that we were trying to solve. Because yes, every company has data quality issues, but not every company suffers to that at a certain level or certain scale. And two, companies that we wanted to work with, people who had the bandwidth to share feedback and iterate with us on certain things. And finally, people that we like, decent human beings that we enjoy working with, because this is a partnership. Like they partner in design partners. And so it needs to go to work in both ways. And that's how initially we were able to work with some of the most amazing companies in the world. And we were really fortunate to have them join us on our journey early on. And initially, obviously, when you start working with design partners, it's very important that you stick to the DNA of your product and that you, at least as a founder or founding team, have an idea of where the mission is going. And you take the inputs of your design partners because they are using the tool, interacting with it, and are data practitioners. So, you know, you're solving problems for them. Use it as you go to adjust and to calibrate, but not the other way around. I see some companies start with from almost nothing and going and hoping that design partners will tell them what to do. That's not how you should build the company. That's not how you should build the product.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. So really, you know, having a clear sort of idea of what you want to build and then leverage
exactly
the feedback of the design partner to support that and iterate on that, not just rely on them to change the vision of
Exactly. Yeah. And it's also important because obviously, as a founder, it's good when you have a certain experience in the space or the problem or certain exposure to the problem you're trying to solve. So you also have an idea of how you would like the tool to look like ideally, or how you want to go about solving the problem. And it becomes a matter of discussing with broader community of design partners, and even not necessarily design partners, external or broader community, in getting constant feedback about what you think is the way to go.
Yeah. Because we're talking about the broader community, so that's transitioned pretty well to my last main question. So how would you describe the state of the AI ethics community in general at this point? I think Ziplat is a global company collaborating with a lot of different tools in one stack. I'm sure you have a lot of experience reading, learning, and conversing with different people in this space. Could you mind sharing some of your high-level perspective on this?
That's a very good question. Honestly, in the beginning, I was pleasantly surprised with how open and friendly the data and analytics community is. Because back to what I said earlier, when I started thinking about building the intelligence layer at my previous company, I was extremely intimidated. And I was so scared to reach out to other people within my own organization to ask them dumb questions. But now, being in the space and seeing how people love to talk about their experiences, how there's a lot of knowledge sharing, there's a lot of communities on Slack, there's a lot of meetups and stuff like that, it's been honestly probably the most surprising thing. And it's been a great surprise. And it's for a vendor in the space, that's actually like a super boost. Because if you have any question, like you're struggling with something, if you want to pick somebody's brain, you can literally just reach out to them on LinkedIn or on Twitter, and you'll find somebody to have answers to your questions. And I think that's amazing about the data community. I'm extremely fascinated by the mentality, and I feel extremely lucky to be making my career in the space now.
Yeah. I think my way of sharing the thoughts, content about some of this topic on the blog, I think you also are doing the part of contributing back to the community. So, Salma, at this part of the conversation, I want to move into the final closing segment, in which I'm going to ask you three rapid fire questions and they can provide the quick answers for listeners. Number one, name three people in the broader data community whose work you admire.
Ooh, this is tough. I really admire and I really respect Zamat. I hope I'm not pronouncing her name incorrectly, the creator of the Data Mesh. I had the opportunity to meet her face to face in London a few weeks ago. She's overall well-rounded, humble, approachable individual. I love that. And what she did with the whole data mesh movement is just insane. I have immense admiration for what she was able to do and how she was able to create this whole movement in such a short amount of time. So she's definitely one of the people that I admire. I have a lot of admiration of, obviously, people who innovated a lot and created a lot of things for the community. I think founders of Snowflake are people that I respect and admire a lot. I think they definitely brought something new to the world. I really have huge respect for some of the data influencers, or how we call them these days, that I follow on Twitter and LinkedIn, and that I get to meet face-to-face in events. So, yeah, without naming anybody specifically, there's plenty of people that I think are doing amazing work for the community. And I feel really blessed to watch their work and to benefit from it.
Got it. Number two, name one book that you recommend for people to cultivate an entrepreneurial mindset.
Oh, I'm going to sound like a cliche. I really liked reading Ben Horowitz's book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things. I think that's like a must read for any entrepreneur or somebody starting a company. I'll give you another less cliche answer. This is not exactly related to the entrepreneurial mindset, but I feel like there's a lot of lessons that could be drawn from the book that I'm about to mention that could be applied to entrepreneurship and teamwork and working with founders and co-founders. And that's the book, let me try to remember the name. It's by Daniel James Brown. The book is called The Boys in the Boat. And the book is about nine Americans who were competing for the Berlin Olympics for rowing competition. And it's filled with amazing lessons. Actually, I need to offer that book to buy for everyone in the team, because it has just amazing learning experiences about teamwork.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that about teamwork and leadership. And finally, imagine that you can send out a single tweet to all the early stage, early career data practitioners on Twitter. What would you tweet about?
Oh, don't underestimate sales skill. As a data practitioner, the data leader, you need to also be a good salesperson because you're constantly selling your projects to get internal buy-in. You're constantly selling your data products to data consumers. You're selling externally to show your data team under the best light and boost hiring and whatnot. So I think sales skills are becoming more and more important to have if you want to have a great career in data.
Yeah, important sales skill. I think that's a fantastic way to conclude our conversation. Salma, I really enjoy chatting with you today, learning about
your upbringing. Likewise.
Yeah, your upbringing in France, your education studying mathematics and statistics in college, your first career working in investment banking, leading sales and trading, the final story, a concrete discussion related to some of the product capabilities of a full data stack observability platform, general high-level discussion related to integration with the tools in the stack, as well as the guide how to build on data teams, then technical advice related to hiring, scaling a company culture, finding design partners, and leveraging the data analytics community as a startup founder in the space. So be sure to include all the points and resources that we discussed in the show notes so listeners get a chance to take a look, follow up, and learn more some of the exciting development at Zipnet in the upcoming years and quarters. Awesome. So yeah, with that, I really enjoyed this conversation and I hope you have a great
day. Me too.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, James. Thank you for having me. I had a lot of fun.
Well, that's the wrap for another episode of DataCast. Hopefully, you have learned something insightful and interesting from my guest today. You can read the show notes from the podcast website at datacast.simplecast.fm. If you want to get instant updates when a new episode is released, either follow me on Twitter or subscribe to my newsletter on my website, jamescaley.com. It is my greatest pleasure that you listen to this podcast and take advantage of the data revolution coming upon us. Goodbye for now.